Greetings and welcome to Flanagan's EcoLogic. I am your host, Ted Flanagan, and I'm joined by Greg Poschman. He's a Pitkin County, Colorado commissioner who is passionate about maintaining the quality of life and the quality of development in the Roaring Fork Valley of Colorado. Hey, Greg, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm doing great. Thanks, Ted, and I appreciate you inviting me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the podcast and a pleasure to meet you for the first time. So,
right. Well, after hearing about you for 30 plus years and you know, in the same circles, it's great to finally have this conversation.
Well, super. What's on the docket this week in your world as a commissioner?
Well, what has been on the docket is that our county staff has asked us to consider floating a ballot measure to raise possibly property taxes, maybe some other sales or lodging tax for building affordable housing in our community. Like the entire country, we have an affordable housing problem. And I keep pointing that out. It's not just here. We used to think it was just us who had an affordable housing problem. And so we started working on it 40 plus, almost 50 years ago. And we have probably the highest percentage of affordable housing units, deed restricted affordable housing, of any place in the nation. And yet we still have a problem with affordable housing for a number of different reasons. But meanwhile, the state has caught up to us. Now, virtually every small town in Colorado has an affordable housing problem, workforce housing problems, as does the nation. And they blame it on the recession in 2008, 2009. Kind of killed the housing construction market, and we've been playing catch up ever since. It seems that the mountain communities in Colorado actually have it worse than most places. And so we're trying to figure out how to address that while also trying to keep an eye on our I'm going to say the mandate we have to grow slowly. We have a slow growth policy in place for 40, 50 years, and we try to maintain a rural bucolic sort of environment in our incredible, beautiful high mountain valley. And that's a challenge. You know, how do you take care of your workforce but maintain your rural nature? And right. So really good urban planning becomes more and more essential. And I think my biggest challenge is trying to bring everyone along on, let's put the density closer to the jobs, closer to the transit, you know, those. So that's what my thing is. But honestly, the biggest thing that's always back of my mind and center is that we declared a climate emergency at the behest of some of our local school children about 5 years ago when I was the chair of the Board of Commissioners. And we've been taking that seriously. And I think about that every day because the existential crisis around climate change and carbon emissions is job one for me. And like if you know, on my epitaph, if I have an epitaph, it will say, you know, he did his best to avert an existential crisis. Wow. So hopefully there'll be somebody there to read that in 100 years.
I hope a lot of people have that epitaph too. But that's fantastic. And Greg, is the geography of the valley one of those reasons that we have this affordable housing crisis? That for the sake of our listeners, I mean, we've got Aspen, very wealthy, high end, up at the, well, it's at the southeastern end of the valley, sort of turned around. But it's and then you got a very long valley, the Roaring Fork Valley, I guess all the way down to Glenwood, which is what, about 25, 30 miles or 40 miles even?
42 miles from Aspen, 42.
But the valley is so narrow that it doesn't really afford as many spots, I guess, as other places.
Well, the thing is that people talk about carrying capacity. And that's an interesting question because carrying capacity isn't just real estate. It's the ability to house, to provide services, to provide water, transportation, all that sort of thing. And our biggest limitation, which we love to ignore in the West, across the entire West, is water. You know, we have the Roaring Fork River watershed here. About 60% of that is now diverted through Trans Mountain diversions to the Front Range of Colorado, which is growing like crazy. And so we see our water resources dwindling and our supply, our reservoirs aren't up to the task of providing endless water, like everybody else downstream from us, is there are about 40 million people downstream using the water that we send that way. We're at the top of the watershed. So we're the first users if it does flow west. And that's, so that's a huge limiting factor. We also had, we put in a very strong growth control and land use code measures 40, 50 years ago, commissioners back in the 70s, because they wanted to, we had about a 26% annual growth rate back in the late 60s. And that, it didn't last long before the commissioners decided they, we couldn't sustain that. We don't want to be the next Hong Kong. We're not trying to build a major city. And so major growth restrictions went in. And so as a result, the supply being limited, the beauty of the natural resources, the ski areas, all that drove a real estate boom in high end. You know, the prices keep going up. So our price appreciation has been phenomenal. If you happen to own land in this part of the world, you know the housing appreciation is greater than probably anywhere else, and has been a, and people don't fail to notice that. So we've got a very strong high-end real estate market, which makes it harder to house the employees who drive the buses and are the deputy sheriffs, clean the toilets and all those things. So our challenge right now, and what I keep pounding the table about, is we really need to take care of the people who take care of us. So anyway.
Now, Greg, you came, you were born in Aspen, I believe, in the Aspen Hospital, as my kids were. In 1959, you've seen this valley grow and develop. And I must say, as somebody who comes back frequently, but I don't live here, I'm always impressed at how beautiful it is and how well the development has taken place. But are you comfortable with what's taken place over the course of your lifetime?
I prefer what's taken place to what the alternative would be. We were talking about carrying capacity earlier before I can go tangential on these things. So you got to pull me back in. But, I prefer what has happened with the growth control measures to what the alternative would have been, because I think we would have had well over 100,000 residents in our upper valley probably by the 1980s had nothing happened. And as a result, now we have a county which has about 18,000 residents on the census. We think that's a huge undercount. But we also know we have a lot of second homeowners. We're thinking we probably have in the high season about 55,000 people a day are crossing the bridge into town and in the valley. And in the low season, the off seasons, maybe it's down to 35 or so. But our census says we have 18,000 actual residents here. So we have a lot of commuters. We have a lot of people here. That level of growth in our county has been 2+%, while the adjoining counties, Eagle County is growing at about 7%. That's a doubling every 10 years or so. Garfield County, which is 40 miles down, almost 35 miles down, is growing at, I think, a 10 or 11% rate. That's a doubling every 6 years. We're not okay with the level of growth like that.
When we have our growth management in place, that keeps the valley looking absolutely beautiful. And therefore, the higher, the more people want to come here and enjoy that, and the wealthy one moves here. And so, what a dichotomy it kind of creates in the valley.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think back to Amory Lovin's comment, which I used to sit at his feet because I would record video of him whenever we needed to do an interview for television, things like that. And I just remember him saying all the problems we have are caused by the solutions to the previous problems. And, you know, the laws of unintended consequences, or, you know, being stuck in a rock in a hard place, you know, that whatever changes we make and whatever rules we put in create the next set of problems. And Amory said it very succinctly, more than I do. But I appreciate that. And I think about it all the time. Finally, on the carrying capacity issue, I think Hong Kong has about the same geographic usable land, than we do. And they've got like 5 or 6 million residents in a valley as big as ours. So when we talk about carrying capacity, you have to say, well, what do you actually mean? If we wanted to stuff 6 million people into this valley and high rises, we probably could. But certainly that's not our ambition. And we're trying our best to keep that rural nature feeling. We have a lot of open space preserved, as you probably know. We have a lot of wilderness surrounding us, and I think of my chief constituency, I'll tell everyone, are the elk. You know, I I look at the elk herds as my the constituents I look out for, because they don't really have a voice. So I try to be their voice. And I think about trying to preserve these open spaces and wild herds and open lands. And that is a challenge, but we've been quite successful at it, I have to say.
Yeah, I can tell you're passionate, and I appreciate what you're doing in this valley. And I want to make sure I just mentioned on the podcast that your mother was a quite a skier, right? And your father was actually in the 10th Mountain Division,
right?
Which, you know, is, in my view, it's just an unbelievable thing that you have that in your roots.
I was incredibly lucky. My father discovered skiing when he was a kid in Pennsylvania. And then he moved to Southern California during the Depression, 1929. I think he was 18? He was 15 and 29. So when he was 18, the family lost everything in Pennsylvania, moved to San Diego, and he ended up joining the San Diego as a founding member of the San Diego Ski Club. And they tried water skiing on boards on the bay. They went up to the mountains and built their own chairlifts or ski tows out of Model T axles and motors, wheels. They did that sort of thing. And so when the ski troops formed in Second World War, he happened to be driving back from a ski trip and he heard about Pearl Harbor. And he and his friends said, "Hey, we've got to join up. Let's get in the ski troops." And over time, he was able to. And so he discovered Colorado then and became a ski instructor for the 10th Mountain Division. So he actually taught winter, survival and mobility skills to the 10th Mountain Troopers.
Camp Hale, probably, right? He was at Camp Hale.
He was at Camp Hale, yeah. He rode in on a blacked out train to a secret base somewhere in the mountains, and it happened to be Camp Hale. And he taught skiing there as a part of a group called the Mountain Training Group. And he said, "We were just a damn ski club." He had a really good time there teaching the generals and the privates alike how to ski. But then he also had to learn the rest of what it takes to be a soldier. And in the war in Italy and on Kiska, they had their first expedition was to the Aleutian Islands. He was a machine gun. He had a machine gun squad. He was a sergeant. He had a machine gun squad. And I think his greatest pride was that he brought back his squad alive from those horrendous battles in the Italian Apennines where huge numbers of 10th Mountain troops were killed. And his guys all came back in fairly good stead. And he told himself as he was being shelled and shot at that if he survived this, he just wanted to ski. And he did his best to protect his knees.
And so he came back and your parents, they came to Aspen in 1950, I think I read.
He helped build the first chairlift in winter 46, 47, the number one chairlift. He worked as putting the wheels on the towers. And then my grandmother had been to the Goethe Bicentennial here. She was a Swiss psychologist and professor at DU in Denver. And she told my parents, "If you want to marry, there's one place I would, I'd give you my blessing, and that would be Aspen, because it's the only place that has a future." That was 1949, and she was right, because no other ski area had a pulse back then, and Aspen was starting to happen. So my mom, who had been a climber and a skier in the Colorado Mountain Club, went to CU Boulder about two years into her term at CU, she was in a sorority. It was, I guess, just during the war, and she said, "I just want to take some time off and go skiing." So she knew she wasn't a good fit for the sorority, because she would rappel out the window of her room to avoid the bridge games, and she would go climbing. She went to Alta, Utah in 1946, spring of, or late 45, she met my father, who had just come back from the war in Alta. And she saw him walk into the Alta Lodge where she was a waitress. And she said, I'll take that one to one of her friends. And they went skiing together and that sealed the deal. They were both good skiers. Yeah. So anyway, that's how we got here.
Great, Greg. And then you grew up in the Aspen area, obviously skiing a lot and mountaineering a lot, and then went to University of Colorado in Boulder, majored in engineering. It sounds like maybe your father's influence, but you came out of that and really filmmaking became your thing.
Right. Yeah. I went thinking that one, we didn't have a lot of money. Skiers, ski bums and skiers don't really, make a lot of money. So I went to the CU trying to figure out how am I going to survive. So I chose the most challenging thing I could, and it was an engineering and business degree. And I ended up with a degree in architectural civil engineering with a solar emphasis. It was the year that Ronald Reagan decided to kill all the solar energy funding. And so I chose a field that kind of went away. But at the same time, I also discovered documentary filmmaking. And that became my career. I started working on ski films with some, you know, well-known ski filmmakers like Dick Durance and Roger Brown at Summit Films, Ski the Outer Limits, and all those old movies from the late 60s, which were the things I grew up on. I got to go work with my heroes who were making films. And it went from ski films to adventure documentaries and wildlife films. I ended up traveling all over the world in the late 80s, mid to late 80s. And 90s, and virtually every month I'd be on a different continent in a different exotic location, filming some fascinating character doing something really interesting, and I just had a fantastic run. I was doing, you know, lions, leopards, cheetahs, bears, whales, giant squid, you know, you name it, all over the globe. And then adventures. We did river expeditions in Siberia, and we did a balloon flight around the world attempt. Several, you know, films about this attempt that Richard Branson was going to do with some other guys. And they never made it around the world, but I had a spectacular time following them and meeting, you know, filming, looking over their shoulder. So I got to work with the likes of Richard Leakey and Jonathan Scott in Kenya and Sylvia Earle and Valerie Taylor, the great underwater filmmakers and shark experts. Peter Benchley, the author of Jaws, was with us a lot of the time, and Stan Waterman, who was kind of like America's answer to Jacques Cousteau, spectacular author and writer and filmmaker who used to give film lectures in the days before they actually had really good ways of distributing films. They would take their films around and lecture. So from Peter and Stan, I learned a little bit about repartee and how to entertain a crowd. Those guys were so much fun to be with because they were always laughing and joking and had a great irreverent humor. And if nothing, I try to emulate them as best I can.
Now, along the way, and congratulations, three times you won an Emmy Award for your filmmaking.
Right. Yeah. You know, I'm trying to remember the first one. Was for a series we did, and it involved wildlife and expedition filmmaking all over the world. And I was part of a crew that made these films, and I was working my way up. You know, I'd started as a sound man and an assistant cameraman, and you know, dying to get your hands on a camera that could shoot television quality film back then was very difficult. It was 16 millimeter film. It costs about $1 a foot to shoot, so they wouldn't just give a camera to anybody. And the cameras are $100,000. And I think now my iPhone here has higher quality imagery. You know, it's just mind blowing. But back then it was really hard to get into that field. And so I worked up over a decade or so until I was a cameraman and then a director. And so, yeah, we won Emmys for that series. And then I made a film, a children's, very low cost children's film about kids who are pen pals between Aspen, Colorado, our ACES, Aspen Center for Environmental Studies, and kids in Malawi who had a nature center on a lake very similar to our Hallam Lake, and we filmed a pen pal relationship that actually became a video relationship when we took the cameras over and the screens over so they could all communicate. We made a film about that on an extremely low budget, and we thought, well, you know, this will never go anywhere. But then Disney found it and bought it and picked it up, and it put us into the Emmy category. And I went to the Emmys thinking this is a waste of time. And Lawrence Fishburne handed me an Emmy at the end of the night. I'm still in shock about that. And then it happened again with another project I did with Sting. I think I only worked with him for 2 days in Paris, filming him, making a film, but they won for the entire, you know, concert film background and all that. And so I was happy to be included in that group too. So it was hard work because that was a challenging job just for the few days I worked on it. But, you know, sometimes you get lucky.
That's great. Oh, good stuff.
Or maybe you always get lucky. And maybe I always get lucky.
Well, you've gotten lucky a few times. Done well. Three cheers. In 2016, you decided to become a county commissioner here in Pitkin County.
Right. You know, that's a quick and easy story if you want to hear it.
Why did you do
I
that?
de- I delivered a film. I made a film for a client who happened to be in the valley about a project that they do in Africa. And he said, this is fantastic. I love the film. It's exactly what I wanted. He said, hey, I've got this idea. You know, you should run for county commissioner. The thought had never occurred to me. And I was actually insulted at first. I thought, wait a minute, I've just handed this piece of creative work. I'm an artist. I've given you this film and you're telling me to change careers. Yeah, thank you very much. But he said, no, seriously, you should talk to your people you trust and see what they say. And so I talked to various friends that I rely on for advice, and they kind of laughed into their sleeves and said, sure, you should do that. Ha ha. And so I did, and it turns out I won the primary. I had two opponents in the primary, won the primary, and then won the general. And it was like being thrown into the deep end of a swimming pool. It's like going to, it's almost like, I guess you could say it's like going to graduate school in a way. All of a sudden, a full caseload of things to work on and study and start providing my input on policy. And so it's been an incredible education. I got reelected after the first 4 years. Nobody ran against me. I guess I must be an intimidating figure. So nobody ran against me after 4 years, and I'm in my halfway through my second term. I could run one more time, and I'm contemplating that now. It'd be about a year before I decide. But the reason I think I would do it again is I feel as if I'm making a positive difference. And that brings us back to, climate change, electrification, the issues of the day, which I think are essential global crises, but we have a local way of dealing with them. And as Hal Harvey says, perhaps the most way you can best effective thing you can do is to be doing this on a local level. So I'm taking that seriously and trying to make a difference locally.
A big issue that you're dealing with, and I think it's hugely complex. I don't claim to understand it, is the Aspen Airport.
Right.
Can you encapsulate what the issue is? I know there's commercial flights coming in and out, and then it's a very busy airport for private aviation.
Right. Yeah. Well, the airports was started back probably in the late 40s, early 50s. It was a dirt strip. One of our esteemed local commissioners, Tom Sardi, was really the whip to make this thing go. And back in the day, we had old DC-3s and Convairs would come in, Aspen Airways. They actually put a JATO rocket assist on the bottom of it in case they needed to electric boost getting out of our valley. We have a one-way single runway airport, which is unusual for a really busy airport. And we're at the end of a valley with big mountains. And so the big challenge is climbing up out of there, because you're climbing up out over a populated area, the ski areas and the residential areas right at the bottom of the flight path. I'm leaving the airport. So that airport has been going great, working fine. But up in the last 15 or 20 years, it has gotten so busy. We have over 300,000 enplanements a year now. 83% of our traffic is general aviation. So we have private jets stacked up coming and going, delivering people. And then we probably have 30 or 40 parked at the airport on the tarmac at any given time, and basically have filled it up. We have two airlines, or at least one contractor. SkyWest contracts to both United and Delta, I think. Is it Delta? I'm blanking. It must be Delta. And they're running commercial flights to cities around the country now, and into Denver. And it's become extraordinarily busy. We're starting to see air quality problems and noise problems. The popularity of our ski resort in our valley is grown to the point now where a lot of people are asking, how much is enough? Do we want to keep growing to accommodate this, or do we want to start thinking of different ways that we can thrive here without having to grow bigger to do so? As we say, that it's it's the ecology of the cancer cell. They have to keep growing to survive and thrive.
But with the airport, is it simply a matter of extending the runway? So is there a desire to bring bigger planes in? Or?
Well, our runway has been extended already as far as it can. But for safety reasons, and the FAA has had a huge push to standardize virtually everything in every airport. They want every airport to have the same standards. We've had exceptions with flight curfews and modifications of standard when they want to get rid of those. And that would require us to widen our runway. If we widen our runway, it would allow a wider wingspan aircraft, which would put us up into the full category 3 of an airport, which could allow much larger aircraft to come in. And the big fear, I think it may be the boogeyman, and I'm not even sure it's real, is that people are concerned that 737s full of package, you know, industrial tourism, sort of package deal tourists will start flying in here in 737s. I don't think that's physically likely because it's just too bloody dangerous. We do have private 737s have come in because there's only one guy on board or two guys and seven dogs, you know, on board the plane. But a fully laden 737 will probably never fly in here. And the FAA tells us that, and our consultants tell us that. But still, that's the big fear of widening our runway, because the FAA has rules about discrimination. If an aircraft is capable of flying into a location, you cannot discriminate against it. So we have got a narrower 100-foot runway right now. It'll accept a 95-foot wingspan. If we go over 95 feet, it goes into a larger, scarier class of aircraft.
Very different than the airport are the wildlife crossings that I know you've been a champion of or an advocate of. And here we've got this Highway 82, people are rocking up and down the valley, getting to work or getting to the ski areas or whatever, and wildlife are being killed, deer and elk, I suppose. And how is that going with getting support for wildlife crossings where you actually create overpasses over these?
Right. Well, there are several ways to create safer crossings for wildlife, overpasses being one, underpasses, certain fencing scenarios, signage, and alert systems. There may be, hopefully, I keep pushing our people to start innovating, looking for new technology on innovative ways to alert animals to turn around or go back, and to let drivers know that their animal's present on a dark night, on a dark highway. You know, we have things like LIDAR, and we've got other sensing technology now, which is so good and getting less expensive that perhaps there are other solutions, because an overpass is $5 to $10 million. The state of Colorado, unfortunately, does not have very much money for wildlife overpasses, although they should. Other states around us have, you know, 5 and 10 times as much in terms of resources for that. So that's something we have to work on at a state level. But locally, there's a lot of interest in it. And a new nonprofit is formed. It's called Safe Passages Roaring Fork Valley. And we've got a very dynamic young woman who started it, Cicely D'Angelo. And I've been supporting her the best I can, helping her build a board, introducing her to donors, helping navigate the things you have to do to get a nonprofit going and build a public movement. And she's up and rolling. We're going to do the first studies on where the overpasses should go, and then start figuring out what it would take to actually get some put in here on this very busy highway. And we're looking at an elk herd and large ungulate herd that's declined by 50% in the last 20 years. So collisions are part of that, as well as incursions into their habitat just from subdivisions and things like that. So that's near and dear to me.
Yeah, I could tell. Greg, you've been involved now as a public servant for what, 6-7 years now. I've read a little bit about you know, some of the shock that you had about the criticism that the public would lay out on elected officials like yourself, and how you've had to become thick-skinned. But I was fascinated by, you know, that you went into public service with high hopes, of course, and then found out, I guess I quote you saying, the public process is really complicated. Are you optimistic? And I think the county commission has been maybe exceptional as a body, but are you optimistic with the process and the way that you've been able to control the growth in the valley and sustain that quality of life that you're so passionate about?
I am. I have to say, I have no choice but to be an optimist, but it's not a hard choice. I am an optimist. You certainly see changing. As you know, you leave town for 2 weeks, you come back and something's changed. This is a very dynamic town. It has been my entire life. So yes, I'm optimistic about it. There was more to that question. But I also see progress where we are doing our best to protect the big, vast tracts of open space and lands that should be preserved. The riparian zones, super important. You know, that supports 95% of our wildlife. We rely on the riparian areas along the rivers. We're doing our best to preserve those. We're preserving the connectivity of the corridors for wildlife habitat, which happens to be at a 90-degree intersection with our highways. The highways basically cut right through the habitat. So that's where we come back to the overpasses. So I have to say, I am optimistic. And also, I've gone from being impatient with the public process, which is painfully slow, to also realizing that we need it, because we often need to go in and check in, which we do a lot with our community, to make sure we're getting it right and to make sure we understand what's going on. I think I'm at a point now as a approaching senior member of the commission that I'm grateful for a slow contemplative process, because we've got to get through the bad ideas before we can actually settle on the kernel of the issue and arrive at the good idea or the best idea, and hopefully not cause the next set of unintended consequences for the next board.
Thank you so much.
Is that enough?
A great discussion. And again, I thank you so much for your service and a fascinating discussion. So it was great to have you.
Oh, gosh, I'm glad. Thank you. I appreciate being here. I was going to try to figure out how to shoehorn some more in about, you know, my appreciation for everything you've done and that what our community of people who are climate conscious are doing about climate change and carbon emissions. And I just wanted to say, I take it all the way back to Eunice Foote discovering the heat trapping capacity of carbon. That's where I start when people ask me what's the big deal about climate change. And I start with Eunice Foote, a woman scientist who was never recognized back in her day, but who's given credit now for discovering the heat trapping capacity of gases. But then you can go up through the years and realize we've known this was a problem for well over 100 years. Yeah. It's high time we did something about it, right?
Let's do it. Teamwork. Thank you.
Nice talking to you.
Take care.
Yeah. Hopefully we'll meet in person for a cup of coffee or a beer one of these days.
I'd love to do that. Okay. Have a good afternoon.
Right. You too. Take care.